From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
Donald Trump addressed Congress. MSNBC's Brian Williams called the address Trump's most speech-like speech. And Jeff Sessions recused himself from any investigations related to the election after it was revealed that he met with the Russian ambassador twice during the campaign. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left, we have Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent at The Nation magazine and MSNBC analyst. And our special guest is Jeremy Mayer, associate professor at the George Mason Schar School of Policy and Government. Welcome, everybody. On Tuesday, ahead of his speech to Congress, the Trump White House started rumors that the president would pursue a pivot on immigration, trying to reach a big deal on the issue with Republicans and Democrats. He didn't actually do that. Trump's speech was substantively a continuation of his agenda, with the same deviations from Republican orthodoxy, calling for a big infrastructure package and paid family leave, while calling for trade protections, warning against crime committed by illegal immigrants, and pledging to build that wall. But Trump's tone was different, and the same policy positions were reframed in a way that seemed more focused on appealing to people in the middle and less at inflaming his base. Liberals were confounded by the positive reviews the speech received. Don't people understand this is the same old Trump? While the responses I saw from some conservatives were conflicted, obviously there was relief that this president to whom their fortunes are bound, whether they like it or not, seemed to be demonstrating relatively normal behavior. But the speech was also not really conservative as such. If Trump makes his approach stick, he might lead the Republican Party to victories, but where will that leave conservatism? I want to hear what all of you thought of the speech. Let's start with you, Jeremy. What did you make of it?
Well, I was very impressed with the tone, like almost everyone else in the punditocracy. But I have to say that bringing Democrats to cheer for protectionism on steel with Republicans is such an alarming development for the progress of America as a free trading nation.
Joan, what did you think?
I thought a lot of people were fooled by it. I really don't think we can afford to be kind of wowed by the fact that he doesn't scream. And I also think that the media was kind of impressed because he wasn't yelling at us for a change. He didn't come out and just say we were fake news, we were liars, we were enemies of the people. And so, therefore, there was a kind of programmed like acceptance or praise of the speech. But I want to reassure Jeremy that, you know, apparently he has now exempted the Keystone Pipeline from using U.S.-made steel. So there's really no reason to worry that he's going to be actually protectionist when it comes to the real world.
Did you share my assessment that I thought Chuck Schumer, when he went on the cable networks after the speech, I thought he looked rattled. I thought he thought the speech had been effective. Do you worry at all that that's true?
I think you're right in that Chuck Schumer worries about stuff like that more than I do, like because that's A, his job, but also his temperament. So I totally agree with you that he did look rattled, but I don't think he needed to be, because within 4 hours, we were talking about Jeff Sessions, which I know we'll get to eventually.
Rich, what did you make of the speech?
Well, I agree with everyone. It was a fine performance, and he just did things that were obvious and very easy to do, and it's been mystifying for a very long time that he refused to do them. Softening his rhetoric somewhat, you know, full-throatedly denouncing bigotry, citing American history in somewhat soaring terms. These just aren't hard things to do, and he doesn't give up anything ideologically by doing them. And in the speech of the joint session, he finally did. And I think, you know, if you evaluate it objectively as a matter of rhetoric, it's a pretty average speech, but it just hit with much more force because it was so different from Donald Trump, and he clearly helped himself.
Did you see conservatism in the speech? Someone was noting afterward that there was literally nothing about social conservatism in the speech.
There is no social conservatism except for the Gorsuch reference, and it's clear that Trump, you know, he's not a social conservative himself, and as we discussed a show or two ago, this is a transactional relationship with social conservatives. He'll do what they want, but he won't necessarily talk about it or tout it very much. And there are conservative policies in the speech, but what was missing was any commitment to limiting government whatsoever. And that's just completely absent. And like Jeremy, I was alarmed by, you know, the Republican applause. They basically would applaud anything he said, even if, you know, 4 months ago, if President Obama had said it, they would have been scowling and sitting on their hands. And that's, at least for the time being, the transformation he's wrought within the party. Whether that's more permanent, we don't know yet. And the big question is just, you know, how he performs and how he's seen 48 years from now. And just no one knows that.
Jeremy, where did you think the speech left us policy-wise? I know you said you were concerned about the trade stuff, but I found listening to it, there weren't a lot of action items in the sense that it gave me an indication of what President Trump was going to focus on as policy priorities over the next 6 weeks, say.
Right. Let's be clear. What's missing from this speech are anything remotely resembling specifics. And for a guy who on the campaign trail continually promised, I'll have something, and never delivered on things like healthcare or a budget, this is very serious. A true presidential speech that mentions a policy initiative, they roll out the details in the next week. And if you think that's going to happen on the things he was talking about, you don't know this man. So another big thing that he didn't say with even as much detail as he talked about domestic policy was foreign policy. To call this pablum would be an insult to pablum.
Joan, what do you...
And pablum's easily insulted, so be careful, Jeremy.
Yeah, they have a big lobby in D.C.
Joan, did you see sketches here? Because another story that's been getting attention this week has been the sort of the secret health care bill on Capitol Hill.
That's locked away.
House Republicans are developing a bill. And in fairness, you know, ordinarily you do develop bill text in private before you release it to the public. But there's been this long set of promises about what health care would be. And I didn't see anything in the speech that gave Republicans any guidance as to what they should put in that bill.
No, not at all, because he can't, and they are terrified. And then I guess the House has locked it away under lock and key in a room, which I don't think we've heard of before. We all definitely do things, you know, we do drafts, we have private meetings, but I don't know about locking a bill away in a room and keeping the Republican senators from looking at it. I mean, Rand Paul got a lot of attention, I guess it was yesterday, for like showing up.
Rand Paul didn't just show up. He dragged a photocopier with him through the halls of the Capitol complex saying, I want to see the bill and make copies of it so I can show it to everyone.
Yeah. It was a stunt, but it was a pretty good one. I mean, it made the point. And, you know, when you've got the House and the Senate Republicans fighting about Obamacare, I'm a Democrat, that's a good thing.
Rich, I guess one word people latched onto in this speech was tax credits. So that was like one specific about what the healthcare plan should do, that it should have tax credits. But otherwise, as the House tries to develop an approach here, did you see any leadership from Trump on that?
Well, basically, both sides in the dispute on the Hill over what replace will look like favor tax credits. They just favor different forms of tax credits. So if Trump had said refundable tax credit, that would have been definitely coming down on the Paul Ryan side of this dispute. But tax credit itself was somewhat vague. My guess
that,
at the end
means,
of the day—
By the way, a refundable tax credit means that you can get the benefit of it even if your income is relatively low. So this is a dispute over how generous the subsidies should be to relatively poor people. And so the Trump didn't really take a side on that dispute.
But my guess is at the end of the day, he will endorse the Paul Ryan replace bill. And it's a question of whether it can get through the Senate and how helpful he'll be trying to get it through the Senate. And I do think he's potentially— a major force on Capitol Hill. He can train his Twitter fire on any recalcitrant Republican who is blocking something he wants to get through. And he'd also be, if he wants to, quite charming and persuasive on a one-on-one basis, you know, having someone play 18 holes of golf with him at Mar-a-Lago and that sort of thing. It's just still a little bit up in the air whether he's interested in engaging at that level.
I wouldn't even expect refundable tax credits would get through the House without some fight. I mean, the Freedom Caucus is going to make a stand on this.
Yeah, this is the thing that's remarkable to me, is you've had a lot of major programs in the past that have been difficult to get the details worked out through Congress, and where people have to accept things that weren't their first choice, and where there's a lot of fighting, but that's generally involved a heavy-handed White House that comes in and says, no, you've talked long enough, this is the way it's going to be, and that whips the votes. You saw that with the Affordable Care Act, you saw that with George W. Bush, with the prescription drug benefit that got added to Medicare. They had to hold that vote open for several hours with Tom DeLay LA running around begging and threatening people to vote for the president's preferred policy. But the as Rich says, I think Donald Trump could be a major force on that on Capitol Hill. It's very clear that Republicans on Capitol Hill are terrified of what happens if the president tweets angrily about them. But I don't think we've seen the depth of engagement from him yet where he's willing to do that on specific matters that aren't necessarily passion projects for him, like the wall. So that makes me wonder if that's going to happen.
Yeah, I agree with you, Josh, and I don't really know if he knows which side he's on. I mean, honestly, if he decides to come down with full force and an explanation of why he's choosing this, he could be very powerful, but he hasn't engaged to that extent yet, so I don't know what he can do.
Rich?
I just think the logic of his position as president of the United States will dictate that he does eventually get quite engaged, because if he doesn't, both Obamacare repeal and tax reform might not happen. I mean, they might not happen anyway, but it will reduce their odds if he's just off on the side taking pot shots or not getting engaged. And then, you know, his first year will be a legislative failure, and your second year doesn't get any better. So I think all that means just inevitably he'll be more engaged than he is now. But for the first time, I've begun to pick up a note of resignation among some Republican operatives and strategists about whether they'll actually be able to repeal Obamacare. And that I would have been stunned by that a month or two ago.
And I also think counting on Donald Trump to suddenly become a workhorse and do his homework and study and engage, not just for a speech, not just for an hour, but for the weeks and months that it takes to get something done in Washington, there is nothing in the man's background to suggest that kind of focus.
The other thing that relates to this is the reluctance of the White House to staff up. And in an interview with Fox and Friends this week, Donald Trump claimed that the reason that there are several hundred positions that are significant and requiring Senate confirmation that he hasn't even issued a nomination for is that he doesn't want to fill a lot of those jobs, that he thinks the government's too big and employs too many people, and he doesn't want to fill all these jobs. But in a lot of cases, these are the people who need to go out there and implement the policies that he's hoping to implement. At the same time, you have the Trump administration complaining about how Obama holds overs and permanent bureaucrats are hostile to them, thwarting their agenda. Well, these are the people you'd expect to have him to have in place if he were going to try to overcome those recalcitrant bureaucrats, and he does not yet seem to be even focused on hiring his own people to pursue his agenda.
Yeah, you can't have that both ways. You know, you've got to understand that the bureaucracy can help you or thwart you and put your people in place, or you've got to kind of let it go. You certainly can't complain that there are Obama holdovers if you haven't replaced them. And he doesn't understand how it works. Look, I'm a liberal, and I'm sure there are some positions that could go unfilled. I'm just absolutely sure of that. But there are lots that are important, and he doesn't have any kind of research, analysis, people with research or analysis of which positions make sense and which don't, and what he needs to help his agenda through. He doesn't care that much. I'm sorry. I mean, Rich and Jeremy basically both said the same thing, but let me add my voice. He doesn't care enough to engage as much as he needs to pull something through Congress, even with both houses run by Republicans. He doesn't.
Well, let us know what you thought about Donald Trump's speech this week on our Facebook page, or message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Jeff Sessions. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Joan Walsh of The Nation magazine. And Jeremy Mayer of the George Mason Schar School of Policy and Government is also with us. On Thursday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that he is recusing himself from any current or future investigations related to the 2016 election. That's because we learned Sessions met twice in 2016 with Russian ambassador to the United States, Sergei Kislyak. A senator meeting with a foreign ambassador is not itself suspicious. Sessions' office says he met with 25 different ambassadors in 2016. But during his confirmation hearing, Sessions had denied that he had any contact with the Russians during the campaign. The news of the meeting set off an intense parsing of Sessions' answer in the question from Senator Al Franken that it addressed. Sessions argues that in the context of the question, he was only answering whether he met with Russians for the purpose of discussing the campaign, which he says he did not do. But Sessions also says he was already considering whether he should recuse himself from election investigations, and that his staff had recommended that he should not oversee investigations related to a campaign he participated in. So he's leaving key decisions, including whether to appoint a special prosecutor, in the hands of a deputy. Joan, is that satisfactory?
I don't think it's going to be. I really don't. I mean, it's not satisfactory to Democrats, a lot of Democrats so far, and I think it's actually going to start to bother and agitate Republicans. I mean, let's just look at the weirdness of what Sessions actually said and did. He was not asked about his own contacts with the Russians. He was asked about reports, Franken read, you know, a newspaper report that there were ongoing exchanges of information between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. And would he be able to be fair if that turned out to be true and if he had to investigate it? He jumped in with the most bizarre answer that, well, I'm a surrogate and I didn't have any of those contacts, so no. And then he gave a really strange look to his lawyer down the aisle. So there's something very weird about it. He didn't have to answer the question that way. He could have simply said, and he should have simply said, of course I will. Or he should have said, well, you know, I myself met with, you know, the ambassador, and it was just a routine conversation that I would have as a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And I don't know why anyone finds that strange or otherwise. There were so many things he could have said that he didn't say. The one thing that he said really holds him up here, and I think it's going to get worse for him.
Rich, this is the thing that keeps coming up that I find so strange in the Trump administration over and over, which is that, you know, there are all sorts of valid reasons why people involved in American politics and government might have meetings and contacts with people from Russia. But if those meetings are incidental and ordinary and not suspicious, why do the people around Trump seem so cagey about them? Why is there this continuous issue with misrepresenting the level of contact with the Russians?
Well, this is one of the things that's creating a lot of smoke around this. I'm not sure there's any fire, which would be, you know, direct coordination with the Russians over the hacking of Democratic accounts and the dissemination of that information. And I'm just not sure why the Russians would need to coordinate with anyone to do that. I mean, they stole the information on their own and walked across the street and gave it to WikiLeaks. And, you know, why would they need to, you know, call Jeff Sessions or have a meeting with Jeff Sessions about that? And I agree with Joan. Sessions' answer was very weird, but I read the weirdness as exculpatory. If he had a cognizance of guilt about this meeting and he wasn't asked about it by Al Franken, and then he volunteered a lie about it for no reason under oath. You know, he's the very worst liar in the history of the planet. That just makes no sense. So to me, I read it, and I know we're all been parsing this very closely, as saying, you know, he had nothing to do with these communications. In the sense of Franken's question, was communications meant some nefarious coordination with the Russians? And sitting with the Russian ambassador in your Senate office doesn't qualify as, you know, nefarious or untoward or, of course, even illegal activity. So I think it was a legitimate misstep. It was incomplete and inaccurate answer. There's going to be a cloud around him because of that. It was appropriate that he recuse himself. But I don't see this getting us any closer to an alleged smoking gun.
Well, so I can think of two reasons why the Russians might want to speak with Trump associates, and not to say that either of these things happened, but one would be if the Russians wanted assurances about policy. That was why people were concerned about the calls that Michael Flynn took after the election. Now, before the election, I assume that, like everybody else, the Russians thought Trump was going to lose and they were mostly trying to weaken Hillary Clinton. So I think that's more of a concern for after the election discussions. The other thing you might coordinate about is what to release. Now, obviously, it's not that hard for the Russians to figure out what would be damaging, but you did have Donald Trump publicly urge them to find and release certain emails from Hillary's server. So I'm not saying there were such contacts. I agree that we haven't seen any evidence yet of such contacts, but I don't find it hard to imagine why the Russians would have wanted to talk to
him.
Josh, there's one other thing, though. There's another reason for them to contact Sessions and other Trump people, and that is changing Republican stance on Ukraine. We learned this week that apparently Trump ordered that. We learned that from J.D. Gordon, one of his former foreign policy advisors, who also went down in flames over Russia contacts.
This was this specific change in the Republican platform language. It was this sort
and
of
as
unusual
Rich knows
thing
better than I, right. That's an extraordinary shift in the Republican Party. In 2012, they were far to the right of Obama and accused him of being too close to Russia. And then to change the platform at the request of a foreign government? I'm sorry, but that we've never seen that. You have to go back to Talleyrand and the 18th century to find something that close to foreign intervention in American policy.
Well, aren't we getting ahead of ourselves to say that that was at the behest of a foreign government? We know the allegation is that Trump ordered that change. I don't think we have any specific evidence that that was a specific request of the Russians.
That's very fair of you, Josh. You're right. We don't know that. But still, it was against the rest of the Republican Party's recommendations, what was in the platform language. And then they came in, and this is the only change they made. They didn't change any language on abortion. They didn't change any language on school choice. They changed language on arming the Ukrainians to help them fight Russian incursions. That's the only thing they did. And J.D. Gordon, who was a foreign policy advisor, who admits meeting with them, is the person who has now said, yeah, we did do that.
But to Rich's earlier point, the fact that it was the only significant change to the platform actually is kind of an exculpatory thing, in that the reason Trump paid no attention to the Republican Party platform, got involved in none of the fights about the platform language, was that he understood that the platform is irrelevant. If he became president, he didn't have to follow the platform. So why would making a change on behalf of the Russians be valuable to Russia when the platform is unimportant?
Maybe they don't entirely understand it's unimportant. But seriously, why is that exculpatory? He should have just ignored it, as Hillary Clinton mostly did. It doesn't matter. But the fact that they felt that they needed to place this X on the ground for the Russians, it makes no sense unless it's connected to
some kind of... And foreign policy platforms have been an issue in policy. Like when we change a word or a comma about Israel, people will die in the streets over that one.
Especially on the Democratic side.
What I don't see is the leap that this was a Russian operation. It very well may have just reflected Donald Trump's friendly attitude towards Putin, which, you know, maybe he's a Russian agent and it was all, you know, a trade where they said, okay, we're going to hack the Democrats. We're going to pretend to try to hack the Republicans just to cover our tracks. And we'll release this information if you reverse the Republican Party's position on Russia. I just find that highly fanciful. And
we haven't mentioned Paul Manafort. I mean, there's so many connections, you guys. Come on.
The funny thing, though, is Josh Marshall wrote this interesting piece this week called The Innocent Explanation, basically describing, you know, the circumstance in which there's no quid pro quo, there's no direct coordination between the Russians and Trump. It's just that over the years, as Trump got shut out from U.S. banks and needed to find sources of funding, he developed these relationships with various shady figures in Russia and came to like them. And in his worldview, where if you're helpful to Trump, you're a good person, it caused him to develop this warm feeling toward Russia and this willingness to adopt the Russian worldview on a wide variety of things. And in a formal way, that is not, you know, that's not a foreign government coming in and taking over. But Rich, I mean, wouldn't you agree that that is in itself a fairly disconcerting thing if he just, you know, has this Russophile attitude?
I hate the Russophile attitude. I don't think it's been proven that he did it for money. And I'm all in favor of, you know, trying to urge him to release his tax returns and all the rest of it. I'm all in favor of a really thorough and bipartisan investigation so we get all the facts out. It's just I kind of doubt the smoking gun is going to be there. But look, I'm all in favor of hawkishness towards Russia. I think it's foolish to believe that we can reach an accommodation that is going to stick or serve our interests. And I've been pleased that he's picked people, you know, H.R. McMaster, and then there was another one this week who don't share this attitude towards Russia, which gives me hope that his policy ultimately, when the rubber hits the road, will be more normalized and be one that liberals usually excoriate and hate, which is a very tough posture towards Russia.
I do think there's been this weirdness in the reaction around Sessions this week where there's a desire to look at every single thing about this as shady. For example, there was this story revealing that Jeff Sessions had used his campaign account to pay for his travel to the Republican convention. And this was viewed as, aha, you said you were there in your capacity as a U.S. senator, but your campaign paid for you to go to this. Now, like, imagine if Jeff Sessions had used his government office account to pay to go to the Republican convention. Everyone would be furious that he was using government funds for what was obviously a campaign purpose. So it seems like, you know, not all of this stuff has to be nefarious, even though there is a lot of stuff around this that, that looks like it might be nefarious.
I'm going to give you that one, Josh. I totally agree.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Jeremy Mayer, what's on your mind?
So we're looking at a president who's proposing this massive cuts to domestic agencies. And as a former Republican, why is he not talking? That's me. Why? I'm angry that he's not talking about going after the tax fattened hyena, the farm lobby. We should zero out agricultural subsidies long before we have a 30% cut in the State Department.
Rich Lowry.
There's been a vague sense out there that a rash of anti-Semitic incidents in this country have somehow been related to Donald Trump's election. There's still much we don't know about this phenomenon, but an arrest has been made of a man allegedly responsible for some of these threats, and he's a former journalist who is supposedly seeking revenge against his former girlfriend. It goes to show that despite what many of his critics think, not everything wrong with this country is the responsibility of Donald Trump.
Joan Walsh.
Although the Trump administration insists that it's only deporting and focusing on people who are here illegally who've done criminal things, that is absolutely not true. A young dreamer who talked about why she hoped he would keep the DACA rules, which let them stay in the country if they were brought here very young, was picked up immediately or closely after her speech. And today, a young father was picked up at a school dropping off his daughter, and he had no known criminal record. Donald Trump needs to be honest with us about what he's doing because it looks pretty awful.
For my rant, we discussed Rand Paul running around the Capitol complex with his copier looking for that health care bill. It seems to be part of a broader strategy by Paul Ryan, where basically he sees all this fighting in his caucus about what the replacement should say. And he thinks, well, if we just dump an Obamacare repeal and replace deal in front of people and dare them to vote against it, we'll be able to get to 218. Now, this is a theory that could work, although if you just Google Boehner Paul's bill, you can find all the stories about when John Boehner tried this strategy and failed to get his caucus to agree on things. But the fundamental problem is that once you release the bill text, which you eventually have to do so that people can vote on it, you're going to have the same issues, which are that people to the far right in the caucus don't really want much of a government role in healthcare at all. They don't want public spending that makes it affordable for people to buy health insurance. And then you have people closer to the middle and people from states that are dependent on the Medicaid expansion who are afraid of what will happen if they repeal the law unless it's replaced with something that's sort of substantially similar, at least in cost, if not in structure. I think the math is very hard to get to 218, and even if you do, you then go to the Senate, which has different priorities, is more moderate. I think the math is really very difficult for an Obamacare repeal and replacement, again, unless Donald Trump decides to do something politically difficult, not just show leadership, but show leadership in favor of some things which will be unpopular with parts of his own party, parts of the broader electorate. That does not seem in character for Donald Trump. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Rich Lowry, Joan Walsh, and Jeremy Mayer. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
You got pajamas.
We know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all. Let's call the
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.